You're listening to EPN, the E-Podcast Network.
Hello, welcome to the Incandescent Radio Show on EPN, the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. At the Incandescent Radio Show, we give voice to entrepreneurs and always ask the question, what's your story? That'll be easier to answer today, for we're here with writer, musician, and all-around funny man Sam Barry, the author of the humorously inspirational book, Write That Book Already, The Tough Love You Need to Get Published Now, which he wrote with his wife, author, and literary provocateur, Kathy Kamen Goldmark. Sam also wrote How to Play the Harmonica and Other Life Lessons, and is currently a contributing editor at Ziza, the West Coast premier literary magazine. For the last 12 years, he was a marketing manager at HarperCollins, and if that's not enough, Sam is equally creative on stage. He plays in and around San Francisco in the band Los Trainwreck, and also tours with the all-rock, all-author rock band, The Rock Bottom Remainders, with whom he appeared on Good Morning America and The Greg Ferguson Show. He is also a regular performer on the national radio show West Coast Live. A gifted music teacher, Sam has helped thousands of people discover the joy of making music on the harmonica and piano, not at the same time, of course. And in a previous life, he was the co-founder of a nonprofit art gallery and performance space in San Francisco's Mission District. He's also been a minister in Omaha and Boston. We can't wait to hear all about your great work, Sam, and when it's time to write that book already, can you give us some tips? And welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's all true. There's even more, but the other parts I can't tell you because they would ruin my reputation. Children would be mortified.
We met you back in 2011 when you were touring with the Rock Bottom Remainders and were here in D.C., and I had the privilege later of interviewing you and your famous, also equally famous funny brother, Dave Barry, for our Be Incandescent magazine funny issue in June of 2011. You guys talked about why it's important to have humor in your life and how adding a heaping helping of humor to funny in your day makes your day not only better, but it makes your life richer. So in this episode of the Incandescent Radio Show, we're going to take a deeper dive with you, Sam, and talk about your books, the business of being an author, and your work as a minister. But first, we want to say up front, Sam, how sorry we are to report that your beloved wife, Kathy, died on May 24th. She was a friend to many, many, many people, including us at Be Incandescent, and we're deeply saddened to hear of her passing.
Yes, it was awful, awful news, and anyone who's been through, Kathy died of breast cancer, anyone who's lost someone to that terrible disease knows that it was an ordeal, but if anybody bore up under it with grace, unbelievable, really extraordinary grace, it was Kathy, who was just a great spirit and funny, really, right to the end. And she was, she was taken from us too soon, but in her too short life, she really lived like 7-9 lives, you know. I mean, she was just such a force of nature. Her energy was so amazing. And so I don't feel like she was cheated because she got so much life, but I feel we were all cheated because she really had a lot more to give. And it broke my heart. It broke, she was one of a kind. And I'm, of course, I was her husband. And you'd say, of course he's going to say that, but I'm not alone in saying it. And if you read her obituary in the New York Times or just saw the tributes to her everywhere on Facebook, you got a sense of how loved she was. So big loss for everybody and for the literary community and the music world. But, you know, Kathy lives on, I think, in all of us in the way we try to carry on and enjoying life and living life to the fullest the way she did.
Well, she's an inspiration, and so are you. In fact, tell us more about what you guys wrote, you co-wrote in the book, Write That Book Already. So taking that wisdom that she shared with all of us and the wisdom that you have, tell us about when it's time to write that book, when you shouldn't write that book, and what you do once that you've written it. How do you promote it and sell it?
You know, I don't know that there's a formula for when you should write a book or, you know, when a book is done. Although I think I would always say to people to not be precious about your writing, and I try not to be precious myself. You know, be open to let people read your work, get honest criticism from people you trust will tell you the truth. you want them to be supportive, but you also want to hear, you know, where you can improve your work, and get it out there and try and sell it when it's ready to go. Some people write, you know, only one book in their whole life, and other people turn out a book every more than 1 year. I know some people, it's amazing, you know, how fast some people can write a book. But it depends on the kind of book and the kind of writer you are. So once you're ready to sell your book, I tend to still believe in the traditional model of getting an agent, because an agent is an objective person who has a financial and career interest in selling your work. And also agents, maybe more importantly even than the fact that they're on your side, they have connections. And nobody has all the, you know, nobody can do everything. And it's tough enough being an author and writer. Without some help getting connected to publishers, it's really tough. Now, there are, of course, authors who can agent themselves, and I know that's possible. But I think for most people, they need to find an agent. And often the hunt, the successful search for an agent can be one of the toughest parts of the process, because you have to convince a professional agent that, presumably a successful one, one that has a track record of selling, that you're someone they should take on. Once you've done that, that's a big step towards getting published. That's my general view, is that people should get an agent. But there is also now more and more self-publishing going on, and increasingly that's a pretty serious part of publishing. But so someone who works now in a bookstore with and sees what's selling, I think the traditional model still is holding up pretty well as the best model for most authors. And there's, you know, you notice that I'm qualifying everything. That's because I can think of self-published people who've just done great. And yet you notice often when someone is a successful self-published author, they will then get the contract with a publisher. So it tells you something that they want to be published by a traditional publishing house.
Yeah, it's a complicated process, we know. When we interviewed you for our 25 publishing rules of thumb for best-selling authors, you and Ridley Pearson, who we also got some advice from, and, you know, 25 altogether, talked about the quest to find an author and what that means and what it means to actually make money from your book. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I first of all, I would say if you want to get rich, or even if you just want to have a comfortable life, I would strongly recommend getting a degree in accounting, pursuing a more logical path, or, you know, if you've got the gift for dentistry. I mean, you know, there are other ways to make money, you know, so I don't think people should pursue a career in writing solely because they want to make a living. I think that's too bad. I wish that there was more, it was more lucrative and authors are more supported. But what I mean by that is, you know, if you need to pay the rent and put clothes on, you get your children clothed, I think make sure you have a job or some source of income. That said, you can make money as an author, but it really takes hard work. And again, self-publishing can be very expensive because you spend all the money, and you may not, you know, you don't have anybody spending any money for you. So you have to do all the marketing and advertising and promotion and public and printing and everything, or producing, since it may be digital. And you may wind up losing money. If you go with a traditional publisher, many beginning authors get very small advances because the publishers they don't know whether you're going to be a success or not, and they're not willing to risk large amounts of money usually on a beginning author. Down the road, we all know the stories of great successes. And down the road, sometimes authors make a living both as a writer, meaning by writing their books and maybe any other writing they might do, but also as a speaker. And if you're lucky, you're a fiction writer, maybe you get some of your books get optioned for a movie. So there's all kinds of ways to actually make a living. But it's hard work, and it takes both talent, you know, 10% talent, 90% hard work, I'd say, like so many things.
Exactly. So after you wrote write that book already, what kind of feedback did you get?
You know, in general, the feedback for that book has been very positive. Write that book already, The Tough Love You Need to Get Published Now, is you know, when we say tough love, it really is just more street talk. Because we're just trying to be honest about the process, and people, I think, enjoy that. I've in my experience, most aspiring authors really just want to hear, you know, real truth. They don't want to be, you know, told that there's some easy path when there isn't one. So, in general, people have received the message well. And again, working here at Book Passage, where we have comp writing conferences, and I can continue to do the author enablers column in Book Page and online, you know, give that preach the sort of message of yes, you can. But you know, again, always trying to be realistic about the work it's going to take, and that there's no, I don't think there's any easy path, and that's true about a lot of things in life, right? That there's no thing that we really wanted to do that's super easy, and maybe that's the way it should be.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting, right?
Yes, indeed.
So that was a little pretty music in the background. I actually have that same ringtone.
Yeah, I just that's somebody's phone here, which I'm sitting at someone else's desk.
And we should say that you are in California. We're here in D.C. creating this podcast. And so tell us about Book Passages, which is based in Puerto Madera.
So Book Passage is the premier independent bookstore in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. And the reason it has emerged is that over the years is because I think they just we do such a great job of author events. We have 800 author events a year, not all of them on site. Some big events we do off site at a nearby university, Dominican University, or at some other venue. Most of them on site for all kinds of authors, all the way from self-published authors to the biggest names in the business and the biggest celebrities. And so recently we did Ina Garten was an event with Ina Garten, you know, the Barefoot of Contessa, and has a new cookbook out. And then the next day I was doing an event was with my friend, one of Kathy's friends, one of the original Rock Bottom Remainders, Barbara Kingsolver. Louise Erdrich was here right before she was given the National Book Award. And so, you know, we have just a lot of wonderful events going on, and I think that's why we stand out among bookstores in the country as one of the great independent bookstores. And maybe your readers do or don't know the term independent bookstore, but that of course means all the stores that are individually owned, locally owned. Like there are other great stores like Powell's or Tatter Cover, and books down, you know, in Miami, or you know, these are great bookstores, and this is one of them. And what we do is not only bring great authors to light, sometimes we discover great authors. Book Passage has picked some of the authors who went on to be, have become institutions in this country as the great authors, but and we picked them first. It's kind of amazing. So I'm honored to be here. The other thing we do are classes for people who are aspiring writers, or other cultural classes, language classes, and art classes. And we do three writing conferences a year. So that's how we stand out. But one other thing about a store like this that's amazing is that you have, and I think this is true of all the great independent bookstores and why they should be supported, is you can walk into one of these stores and there'll be someone there who really cares about and loves and is passionate about children's books, who can help you pick the best children's book for your grandchild or child or niece, or someone there who loves mysteries and you will find you the best mystery, the unknown new mystery writer. Or someone like Elaine Petricelli, our owner, who people flock to hear her talk about the great books that she has read and what she's recommending. Elaine's picks really draw crowds. People just want to hear, well, what's Elaine reading? And you can't get that anywhere else. You certainly can't get that online. And, you know, you can get that in independent bookstores, and you can get it if you go to your local library. And that's why I think independent bookstores and libraries have to be supported. They are cultural lifelines for us.
Absolutely. We agree. And politics and prose carries that kind of a cachet.
Oh, what a great story.
Yeah. Yeah, we love that. And it's very exciting. And, you know, I think you find that there in communities where there's lots of big thinkers, like you have in the San Francisco Bay Area, that these independent bookstores are really well supported.
Yes, indeed. You know, I mean, and I hope that we, I wonder if we can, there's been a revival of the local bookstore of late. You know, Ann Patchett bought one, notably in Nashville, and the author, Ann Patchett, you know, sort of put her money where her heart is and bought into a bookstore there. I wonder if there's a revival going on of your little bookstore, because I think we've gotten past a little bit the infatuation with, the infatuation with the e-book, which of course is here to stay, but I mean the infatuation with it is the new thing that will change everything, because we still need books and we still need authors and we still need somebody to sell and tell us what's out there. And the infatuation with big store bargain stores. Now that probably won't go away. The online process is going to go away. I'm not a Luddite, but I mean, I think there's sort of a renaissance of needing to have a local place where you can go and talk to somebody and meet people who are also interested in what you're interested in. Because working here, I find it's like this is a community center. So people gather here of like mind, and I think people also meet their dates here sometimes. So kind of fun stuff happens here that can't happen, you know, that just happens in an organic way that can't happen elsewhere.
Yeah, like Whole Foods has the same kind of pull.
I mean, honestly, I think it's a sort of renaissance of the local store in that way. And I certainly hope so, because I love, because it's a village. It's the sense of a community in a village.
Yeah, I think that's backed up by, this month we also interviewed futurist Andy Hines, who talks about the future of work and a lot about the millennials. He had done a study for MTV on the future of youth happiness, what makes people under 30 happy. And it's really, it backs up what you're saying about how sense of community is equally important. These people, you know, the millennials spend money, but they want to have an experience, and they're very particular about that. So I think that might tribute to what you're seeing as a trend.
Yeah, and I know that we evolve as beings, and we evolve as we get new technology. I know that we evolve somewhat based on the technology we have, but we don't change that much, and we're still human in flesh and blood, and we don't need to hear each other's voices. So there's nothing like sitting here for me and hearing, Barbara Kingsolve or reading the other day to really get a sense of the book she had written and her as an author. Just nothing like that, you know. Or so I don't know. I'm just honored to be a part of it, and I think it's a great thing that Elaine Petruccelli and her husband Bill Petruccelli do here, and other great people here. Calvin Cosby, who's the general manager, just do great work. Karen West, our events director. It's a great team that I'm part of. And to get back to your question, though, of making a living, you know, books are not something you go into to get rich any more than you would. You know, I have, a gift for going into lines of work where you don't get rich. Mystery. I'm a musician and I'm a writer, and working here, working in publishing and working in at this bookstore. None of them are the usual routes to great riches, but they're great riches of the spirit and mind, so I enjoy that part of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, where else am I going to sit and in walks Elaine, in walks Isabel Allende, to have a cup of coffee? I mean, this is just kind of a wonderful place to be.
How exciting. You mentioned Barbara Kingsolver. Glover. And as being a part of the Rock Bottom Remainders, tell us a little bit about being part of that cool author band. And I know your brother Dave Barry is in it too. And Kathy actually founded the Rock Bottom Remainders ages ago. And it raises money for notable charities. And just tell us a little bit about that, what it's like to be up there on the stage. When we saw you, you were playing with Roger McGuinn, who was another one of our Entrepreneurs of the Month, just an amazing musician. So
yeah. Well, the Rock Bottom Remainders are a kind of one of a kind band in that, they're basically we're a glorified garage band. We've always made an effort not to be recorded because we don't want to hear it again. But we're a lot of fun. And what we do is put on a show which, features, to be able to stand next to Stephen King while he's singing and strumming his guitar, not that he's much of a guitar player, mm-hmm. he wouldn't claim to be, but he's Stephen King. He's one of the great writers in America. Or Tam Scott Giroux standing next to me in a blonde wig, singing his heart out, or Amy Tan with her famous dominatrix outfit, singing "These Boots Are Made for Walking," and you mentioned my brother Dave, of course, singing with him on Mitch Albom, doing his Elvis impersonation, and Roy Blunt Jr., who has absolutely no musical talent whatsoever, but is one of the funniest men in the world, and all he has to do is introduce us to make us all laugh. And Roger, we've always had a ringer, a rock ringer, and you're right, Kathy did found this band originally. It was just supposed to be a one-off over 20 years ago, and everybody had too much fun and kept going. Kathy, when she founded it, the original, we had ringers, and one of them was before Roger McGuinn, who used to play with the Birds. Our earlier ringer was Warren Zevon, whom people would know from maybe most of all from the song Werewolves of London, but many other great songs. And we just have a blast, and always had a blast doing it. Our last shows, sadly, were right after Kathy died, and were kind of tributes to Kathy 20 years on, and also to, just to her spirit in a way. And I wonder whether we'll do it again. We just don't know. We all have so much fun and love each other so much. It's honestly really a band of people who are friends as much as they are famous authors. In many ways, the most fun part of the Remainders is being on the bus going from here to there with Matt Groening, who's another Remainder, hearing him. He's another one of the funniest men in America, I think, one of the funniest people in America. And, just hearing them all talk and catching up, that's as much of the fun as anything. So I think we want to do it again, but, we're sort of putting it on hiatus now since May 24th, or since the shows right after that, which were tributes to Kathy. But we are doing something really interesting. We're writing a book together. Right now it's digital in format, and it doesn't. The title is still being decided on. It's Colloquy. Do you know that publisher in the Bay Area?
Uh huh.
They are doing it, and I'm working with them. I'm the general editor, and then we're all contributors. So I got an essay from everybody, from Steven and Dave and Roy and Scott and Amy and everybody, but of course Kathy and Ted Abnegaber, our manager. Sorry, but we still haven't decided on a title, so we're still working on it. But it should be coming out in the new year, it's multimedia. It's our essays. You imagine how strange it was for me to get essays from my big brother and from Stephen King and from Amy Tan and Scott Drew and Roy Blunt Jr. And I'm supposed to edit these guys, these people. Anyway, I gave them little suggestions. But, then also, though, there's going to be video and sound and pictures and images, of lots of memories and great times that we had. So watch for that. That'll be coming out early next year sometime.
I will look for that.
Excited to have been a
Very cool. So what was it like to grow up with Dave Barry as your big brother? It must have been a funny table to sit around at dinner.
I mean, humor was the lifeblood of our family. I think it, although, you know, it's, our dad was a man who did serious work. He was a Presbyterian minister and a social activist. He was the executive director of a thing called the New York City Mission Society, which sounds very 19th century, but in fact what he did was civil rights action and community organizing in New York's inner city. And so he was a man who was facing some of the most serious issues of our day, but he had a great sense of humor, and the woman he married, our mom, Marion, was just one of the funniest people in the world. And she, although sometimes I would say, if anything, her humor was a little edgy for, you know, a 5-year-old, but or a 10-year-old or whatever we were. But she was just so funny, and I think humor was just to how I was taught, and Dave was taught, and Phil and Katie, our sister, our brother and sister, all learned to use humor as a way of addressing. Really, in many ways, addressing the craziness of this world and life, you know. I find that humor is, one thing is it puts people at their ease, and the other thing about humor is that it is a way of dealing with the fact that this is a kind of, to get a little serious now, but a kind of a scary and crazy world, right? And so if you can't laugh about it a little bit, I'd go crazy if I couldn't laugh about it.
Do you think it's something that you're taught to look at things so that it's, you know, you have that humor piece?
Yeah, I think we were taught to look at everything a little bit sideways. You know what I mean? You know, I feel like, because the things that come into my mind and the things that come into my brother Dave's mind and all of our minds, I think, you know, is just that absurdist worldview. And, I mean, if you just read my brother's stuff, I've always been a huge fan of my brother's work. And it's just a slightly, you know, that instantaneous absurdist view of any situation, or that strange thought that comes into mind, and we just were taught to voice it, you know. And maybe everybody thinks of things, but we just learned we didn't stuff them. We went ahead and said them. Maybe that's what distinguishes us.
Well, I think you say it well. You know, I think that's the difference. People think it, they want to say it, but they know it's not going to come out right.
Yeah. So it's got me into trouble, because that guy's gotten all of us into a little trouble down there. But also, because if you're a good talker, you can get into trouble and then back out of it again.
Oh, there's an art both ways.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I want to sign up for that.
I never got eaten up, and neither did Dave. Seems like we could always talk our way. We got so much trouble that we, you know, couldn't carry on.
So growing up as a son of a minister, is that what inspired you to do it as well?
Maybe a little bit, you know, because that's such a serious, for both the fact that, you know, ministers preach this, you know, serious message. He wasn't, by the way, a minister of a church. Mm. Our granddad was. He was also a Presbyterian minister, and he had a church. But our dad, you know, was really more of an activist, but he did preach a lot. He would guest preach. So, yeah, we heard that very serious message, mostly about social action and social gospel. But that's pretty serious stuff. And, you know, the civil rights era, that was in Vietnam and all that was going on, and it was a very serious time in our country. Of course, I guess it's always a very serious time. But maybe you need a little relief, right, from the gravity of everything. So that's, I think, that's a big part of humor, too. Without that, I mean, how else would you keep your sanity?
Exactly. Right? So how long were you in a minister for?
Although I'm not sure I've succeeded in keeping sanity. I was a minister all told, that whole stretch of my life is really about 10 years, I think, with my education. So it was pretty serious and sort of the preliminary work I did. And then I was a pastor for 5 years in Omaha, Nebraska. It was the main place that I worked, which is, I often say to people, I lived in my life, I lived in the New York area and San Francisco, those two the most, in Los Angeles, Boston, and Omaha. And then I say, which of these things is not like the other? Because Omaha always stands out. And I'm really grateful for those years in Omaha, because my mother was from Nebraska, sort of a Colorado, from that sort of region, Dust Bowl era region. And my dad was from Ohio, and so they taught us not to have that, you know, myopic, New York world. You know, some people, I love New York, but I mean, sometimes we New Yorkers or San Franciscans can be a little bit closed-minded about the rest of the country. And our parents taught us not to think that way. And then living in Omaha really reinforced that, that, you know, there are wonderful and interesting people everywhere. And also that we had very narrow, those of us from the bubbles like San Francisco and New York sometimes can think that everybody out there is a yokel and that they're not experiencing the same realities as the rest of us, when in fact they are. So, I mean, I learned how diverse the population of a small town in Nebraska could be. I remember going to a small town outside Omaha that was one-third white, if I can characterize it racially, that's serious, but one-third white would be the demographic you would use if you were the Census Bureau, one-third Latino, and one-third Vietnamese. And this was some of the small town outside of, you know, in the middle of nowhere in Omaha, outside of Omaha. And I don't think people in New York and San Francisco realize that in Nebraska they're experiencing a changing world just as much as we are on the coast. So I was just grateful for it. It was just opened my mind about people. And that was also during the heyday of the gay ordination and those battles in the Presbyterian Church. And I mean, I was glad to be there, although those were pretty ugly fights. I was on what I view as the right side, which is gay rights. But, you know, I learned a lot about human nature and the struggle for everybody to get along and people to have their rights.
Yeah. What made you get out of it?
I think a couple of things. I'm not sure that I wanted to. Some of it was personal and family related. You know, it wasn't a natural for my marriage was struggling, and that's not an easy thing to have happen when you're trying to be a minister. Another thing was that maybe I honestly, you know, this is going to sound really ridiculous, but I wasn't sure I believed if what you're supposed to do is preach the gospel. And if you don't absolutely believe what you're preaching, that's a little strange. And I honestly, now that's going to sound strange because I never really was sure I believed totally anyhow, but a lot of great religious figures, much greater than me, struggle with whether they believe or not. You know, I think that's something a lot of people don't realize, is that plenty of people who are, that we think of as religious, are doubters, you know. Mm-hmm. But I was a big doubter, and I just didn't know if I believed or not. I still don't. So maybe I was a little uncomfortable in the role of leading a congregation of people when I wasn't sure I believed myself. But, you know, having said that, I was pretty good at it.
So I bet.
Kind of interesting. I think the biggest thing was discomfort with the role and that my marriage was struggling at that time.
This was before you were married to Kathy. This is your first marriage?
Right. This is the mother of my children, Pat, who's a great woman. But, you know, we had a tough time in our marriage, which probably a lot of your listeners know about that. So I don't need to explain that. And, you know, so it's hard to be under the microscope. It's almost like you're the papa in a little town, you know what I mean,
yeah.
When you're a minister. It's a tough role. I admire people who do it well.
Wow. You've had so many great experiences in your life. Last question for you today. What's one tip you would share with others about having a good life, whether it's writing that book or being a musician or living your dreams or finding your soulmate?
You know, the one tip is one of the simplest pieces of wisdom that we all know, really. But I think we have to remind ourselves 20 times a day, which is, this is it right now. This is life right now today. And not to spend our time, you know, saying, well, when I get there down the road, then I'll start enjoying myself. You have to enjoy it now. Even if it's not ideal, you have to find a way to enjoy the moment, because this is where we are. This is life. And I know that's a cliche, the staying in the moment, but I think it's one of the truest pieces of wisdom anybody can grasp. And I every day I have to work to remember that this is it right here, right now.
That is beautiful. Thank you for sharing that and for sharing your time with us. Tell us where people can read more of your writing and also buy that book already.
All right. Well, they can either one of my two books that are published in print form, How to Play the Harmonica and Other Life Lessons, or, and the other one is Write That Book Already, The Tough Love You Need to Get Published Now, are both available in the bookstores. Just go and ask by my name, Sam Berry. And the, of course, as I mentioned to you, the Rock Bottom Remainder sort of remembrance that we're going to be doing, sort of a group memoir, and also a tribute, and also it's going to be dedicated to Kathy, is coming out early next year. That is a what they call a live book, or, you know, it's not a traditional printed book because it's going to be multimedia. And I think people, fans of all the many Rock Bottom Remainders, Stephen King, Dave Barry, Amy Tan, and so forth, will enjoy that book. And lastly, they can always go see me, find me online in Red Room, which is a where my website where I write a blog. I think they'll. People would enjoy my blog. If they enjoyed hearing me today, they'd enjoy reading my blog, which where I make observations on life. And anytime that they're in the Bay Area, they should come to Book of Passage and see me. I'm the guy who's tweeting everything about Book of Passage. I'm the guy who's on Facebook, both as myself and in Twitter, and also as myself on Facebook, but also I'm the guy behind all the Book of Passage messaging. And they should get in touch. I'd love to hear from anybody.
That's excellent. Well, we're going to come see you in San Francisco soon. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. This is the Incandescent Radio Show, giving voice to entrepreneurs. And we always ask, what's your story? If you have a good one and would like to be interviewed on the Incandescent Radio Show, send me an email at hope@hopegibbs.com. And continue to check out our show that airs every Monday on epodcastnetwork.com. You can also log on to www.theincandescentradioshow.com. And that's incandescent with a K, because we're the writers here at Incandescent. This is Hope Gibbs, founder and president of Incandescent PR, and your host for the Incandescent Radio Show on EPN, the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. We'll see you next week.
This is the ePodcast Network.